Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Well, let's stop just for a moment. I want to reintroduce you. You're listening to Your True North, and today I'm talking with New York Times bestselling author Brendan Kiley. Brendan, I want to ask you about the most influential person in your childhood and how that person specifically really impacted your understanding of what's important in life. I know you've mentioned both your mother and your father, and I don't know if you would talk about one of them or somebody else, maybe a teacher or some other person in your life.
Sure. I know I've talked about both of my parents quite a bit, and I certainly would put them in the pantheon. I can never name just one. I think we live in a pluralistic society, and we have to have multiple heroes. So I want to give a little bit of airtime to a teacher as well, because I think there's something really important about the teachers who take these kinds of risks. And one teacher in particular was a fourth grade teacher, Mr. Lassise, who I think I owe a great deal to. When I was in school, I was, sometimes I was that kid who would talk out of turn often. Mm-hmm. I would act up in class, and I was probably a real pain. And Mr. Lassise sometimes had a nickname for me called Kylie the Complainer. I don't know what I said or what I complained about, but I'm sure I complained about homework and rules and all these other things. And I'm sure I got in the way, and I know that I got in trouble fairly often. But I remember a time when we had to do an oral book report, and my mother helped me with it, and we took it very seriously. And I got to class, and everybody else was just getting up and holding the book in front of them and talking. I came to class dressed in a toga with a laurel wreath, and I tried to embody Zeus, king of the gods.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
As I talked about Dolores' anthology of Greek mythology, and I delivered my oral book report as Zeus, king of the gods, holding my tinfoil lightning bolt. And and Mr. Lassise, said, "Come with me." And he dragged me down the hall to the sixth grade classroom. And the sixth grade teacher loved Greek mythology. And he said, "You have to hear this. You've got to see this." And he made me present my oral book report in front of the entire sixth grade class. And I don't know if I actually wet my pants or if I had that feeling. But, I was mortified, but I tried. And I did it. And it was an uplifting feeling, and it was amazing to see, that even the sixth graders clapped and whatnot. And it was an empowering moment. He nominated me for an after-school group called Odyssey of the Mind that I then participated in for years after that. Yeah. And it was because of this report. Why do I bring this all up? I bring it up because what he did was he provided an opportunity to someone who is often a pain in class. He provided it. He saw, a fuller me, a me that could develop into something, as opposed to dismissing me and saying, "Here's someone who tries my patience." And I think about that as an educator. I think about that as an everyday human being in a city of 9 million plus people. About the value of trying to see the best potential in people, and the idea that if you give them just a little bit of opportunity, they might very well run with that and even surprise themselves with what they can do and who they can become. And I'm grateful because I think I learned that lesson from Mr. Lassise, and I try to apply it, as I said, in all those aspects of my life. Because I'm grateful that someone gave me the opportunity to just step outside of my usual role as fool and instead become someone who could embody the arts and use them to try to do some good in the world.
Well, that's a wonderful story, right down to the tinfoil lightning bolt, the very specific gritty details, but also what it taught you. You know, at fourth grade, you're 10 years old, and yet look at the impact that that made on your education, getting involved with Odyssey of the Mind, and today yourself as a teacher and as a citizen of the world who recognizes that, yeah, we all have potential, and if we're given opportunities and people believe in us, it can make such a difference in how our lives turn out. Well, now I want to ask you, I know I heard you lecture here in Grand Rapids a few months ago, and you said something that I found particularly intriguing. You were talking about American history and how much you're learning now as an adult that was never taught in school. And you weren't referring to little details, but to major events and issues, such as the treatment of the Native American people here in the Western Hemisphere. And you put it this way. You said, why was I shielded from knowing the truth? And that seems to be a theme to me in your work, uncovering ugly truths and looking closely at them so that we can hopefully learn and build a better world. And I'm wondering where that impulse comes in from you, comes from in you, whether it was taught to you, an experience that you can point to, or maybe something else that you feel has really led you down this path in life.
I think, I thank you. I really appreciate that. I appreciate you reflecting on that moment because I really enjoyed my time there, and I'm grateful that I get the opportunity to be invited around the country and talk to folks and present these ideas through the content of the books that I write. And as I think about your question, I struggle to say that there's one moment because, again, I think it really is more interconnected moments that build on each other. I think about some of the my work as an educator and thinking about how I wanted to do so much good, but recognizing only later or really being told by others how much I didn't know, that made me reflect on whether or not I was being a good teacher. And I'll give you one anecdote, and I'm going to connect it back to the comment that I made in Grand Rapids. I remember wanting to teach Jamaica Kincaid. No, I wanted to teach. Yes, I wanted to teach a Jamaica Kincaid story, a girl, in one of my high school classes. And I remember trying to do so and trying to talk about some of the cultural touchstones within the short story, but not being from where Jamaica Kincaid is from at all, I was really missing some of the elements of the story. And so, fortunately, I had a colleague who did know a lot more, who was a woman of color, who had emigrated from the Caribbean and had some further information. So, I invited her in to co-teach the class with me, and it was such a richer class. And it occurred to me, and as she shared with me as well, you know, I know you wanted to try to do something good here, but there's a potential to do more harm when you're not aware of what you're ignorant of. And that sticks with me powerfully because I think about how often good intention can still lead us to do some pretty terrible things.
Boy, that is so very true.
And as I think about that in regards to what you were mentioning historically, I think about how when I was growing up, how often people like myself who come from Irish immigrant backgrounds, people I grew up with who come from Italian-American backgrounds or Polish-American backgrounds, i.e. all white American backgrounds, often like to reflect on the narrative of how somebody in our family pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. And it's a narrative that's so deeply ingrained in the kinds of movies that I watched while I was growing up, the kinds of novels that I read while in school, the kinds of stories we hear the older generations in our families tell us. And yet I didn't know until much later in life, in fact, until I was an adult, the real impact of the GI Bill lifting my family up into the middle class in a way that black families didn't have the same access to. And there's no way that that's pulling ourselves up from the bootstraps. It's a form of affirmative action that white folks had access to that folks of color didn't. And to not recognize that, the real impact and the real truth of that, but to be living on kind of a mythologized sense of American history is what bothers me. I don't want to do that. I don't want to perpetuate the mythology of a fake sense of meritocracy. I want to address the real truths that have helped me and supported me to this day. I think part of why I want to reflect on that is to your point, part of the point of your question is that not only am I perpetuating injustice, I think, if I perpetuate the myths of meritocracy and pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps, et cetera, of talking about westward expansion as opposed to genocide. Not only am I perpetuating injustice, I'm also robbing myself of a piece of my own fullest humanity. Because wouldn't I want to know the truth of who I am and where I come from? Wouldn't I want to know and deal with it as opposed to live a life of denial or ignorance? And so I'm grateful for my colleagues of color who in time have had the patience and care to say, hey, Brendan, here's an opportunity for you to be a little bit wiser. And so as a white person, I would listen to their wisdom because they have a lot more than me. I likewise think about this as a man in our world today, because so often some of the injustices in our society are perpetuated by boys saying, well, this is just guys being guys, or this is just the way I'm accustomed to talking a lot and having people hear me. but instead, maybe I need to take the time to listen to the wisdom of women who so often haven't had as much of a airtime or a megaphone as I have.
Yeah, so you're pointing out both that by believing in the mythology, we don't understand the real truth, history as it was lived, and impoverish ourselves, but it also impacts others, and we aren't really being honest about the advantages that some groups have relative to the disadvantages of others.
Right.
And I know, you know, you're clearly comfortable with looking at these really tough issues, sometimes painful things. And I want to just talk specifically about your first novel, The Gospel of Winter, in which you look at a teenage boy who turns to a Catholic priest for help and is then molested by that priest. And I'm wondering how that story came to be, how you were able to write this book.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I don't get the opportunity to talk about this book very often, so I'm grateful to talk about it. And this book was almost 10 years in the making before it was on a bookshelf, and so there's a lot that went into it. Part of it was that I worked for Little Brown and Company, the publishing company, in 2002. When the Boston Globe broke the news story, the spotlight team of the Boston Globe broke the news story of the vast scandal of the cover-up of abuse in the Catholic Church. And, you know, the movie Spotlight has really brought that to light again and recently. And I wrote The Gospel of Winter before that, but it was something that really stuck with me because, you know, if you remember the details, at the very beginning of this news investigation, they uncovered 96 priests who had been abusing children and essentially being protected by the institution of the Catholic Church, 96 priests in the Boston area. That number, of course, grew, and of course, it wasn't just the Boston area, it was internationally the case. That story bothered me, to say the least, because of where I come from and who I am, and in particular, the fact that on some level, part of my definition of the word love is informed by Catholicism, is informed by the Catholics of my life, is informed by my family, is informed by my religious education, and I felt like that story, in a nutshell, was a corruption of the word love. It was the worst kind of sin to put it in that language, because it was hypocrisy at the deepest, most ugliest level. And I wanted to write about that, because what I wanted to write about was that happens out there. To pretend that it doesn't would be really dangerous. But instead of looking at it from the perspective of how do we as a society, you know, deal with this, I wanted to look at it from the perspective of how does the young person who has to be courageous enough to speak the truth get to that point of courage and actually say something. And I really wanted to write a story of the turmoil and how steep that hill is for someone to say, this is what happened to me. Because so often it's so hard for people who have been abused or traumatized, where violence has been done to them in some way, for them to find the courage to speak, because all too often people don't want to hear it. All too often people say, don't talk about that, et cetera, et cetera. And so on some level, it's quote-unquote easier to be silent.
Yeah, well, and as you're saying that, I'm thinking too, and it's not just any adult. It's an adult who's in a position of great authority, and not just authority, but religious authority. So right. For a child to be honest about something like that, I think there's so many barriers. And so please, yeah, go on.
No. I agree. I absolutely, all those barriers are in place. And the hope for me while writing the book was, if I can write a book about, and I think this is part of the power of fiction, is that if I can sit a reader in the space and the pain of someone having to try to muster the courage to speak up and say, this is what happened to me, to speak truth to power, especially against all those other barriers, then why can't the rest of us also bear some of the burden of speaking that truth to power? Those of us whose hills aren't quite as steep, even. Don't we, in fact, have a moral responsibility to echo and megaphone those truths? I think that's true, and I think I wanted to write the book because I wanted to sort of use Aidan's story as a piece to get readers and those of us in the world who are thinking and feeling beings to ask ourselves, how could we do a better job amplifying and supporting these voices. I was specifically talking about folks who were abused in Catholic communities in the Gospel of Winter, but it's the same theme that motivates my writing, co-writing of All American Boys. When thinking about white privilege and thinking about racial injustice, it's the same theme that motivates my most recent book, Tradition, and thinking about misogyny and a kind of institutional abuse and silencing of young women and their pain and experiences in schools across our country. In fact, they're all interconnected, and in many ways are the same story. And as my grandmother said, which I'll end with this in my long talk, and I appreciate you giving me the time to say this, when my grandmother, who's the kind of Catholic matriarch of the Kiley family, read the Gospel of Winter, My fear, of course, was that people were going to say, oh, Brendan, why are you writing this book? What are you doing? How could you do this, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
My grandmother said, Brendan, your book reminds me of Solomon asking God for a listening heart. Mm. And I found that to be so tremendous. I'm almost going to cry right now.
Yeah.
The spirit behind the book that she really got, and I am so grateful for, is that if we can do a better job listening as a society, maybe we can do a better job being more equitable. Maybe we can do a better job supporting those who need that support. Maybe those of us who are leaders can do our real jobs as leaders if we can actually try to nurture a listening heart.
Yeah, and listening is, as you're saying, it's just a huge thing to actually stop and consider what someone else is saying. I recently heard Rachel Den Hollander speak, and she was the first woman to talk about, to bring charges against Larry Nassar at
yeah.
Michigan State University, and she was the last one to read her victim statement in the court. And she started out her talk here saying, how much is a little girl's life worth? And that struck me as just such a powerful way of capturing how much is a little boy's life worth. you know, a little girl, a little boy, or anyone in our society, and why are some lives so much more privileged than other lives? And it does start with listening to what people say and also being willing to speak, as you're saying, speak out on behalf of others, help them to find their courage to speak out and tell the truth of what's happened to them, and then take it seriously and act on it. So your grandmother, with her point of view about your book, The Gospel of Winter, is really a great story to share. Thank you.
No, thank you. All wisdom really goes back to grandma.
Well, that's right. They leave a deep imprint on us, don't they?
Absolutely. I'm grateful for mine.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take another brief moment. I want to remind our audience, you're listening to Your True North, and today's guest is Brendan Kiley, author of several novels, including Tradition and The Last True Love Story. Brendan, so here's a different kind of question. I think we learn a lot about other people by knowing something about where they live. And I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about some aspect of your home, whether it's your kitchen, your library, the garden, the home office, and what it is that you love about it, just so we get a little more insight into you and your life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I'm laughing because I'm while we're talking, I'm standing and glancing back and forth between the bookshelves in my little apartment office here and the window to the street, and I think it's a good way to describe where I live and how I live. My wife and I just recently culled through all the books in our apartment. My wife, Jessie Chafee, is also a writer. Her debut novel is called Florence in Ecstasy, and it's a remarkable novel. In fact, actually, I recommend it for the show because it deals with Catholic mystical saints in Italy, women who starved themselves in ecstasy for God.
Oh, wow. And
it's remarkable, but I'm bringing this up because we just culled 30 shopping bags of books from our bookshelves that we're giving away.
that's a lot of books. 30 bags of books.
It is, and yet our bookshelves are still full. So part of the way that we live in our household is we live by literature, and I remember one of the first lines that Jessie said to me when we were first getting to know each other is that she spoke about we were pretentious young lovers, and we were talking about philosophy on our one night we were getting to know each other, but I remember that she said that she the way that she looked at maybe how we look at the world was that we read the world. And I really, that always sticks with me because she and I are both such big readers. Reading and literature are a part of our lives. We met in graduate school together for creative writing. And so of course our house has to be like filled with books and books from all around the world, in fact, because, Jessie also works for an organization called Words Without Borders. That's an, online magazine of work and translation from around the world. And the other half of that anecdote is that I'm looking out my window, and I look down the street, and we live in the West Village of Manhattan, where Jessie grew up. And this view always makes me feel so grateful and motivated, because when I moved to New York in 1999, I moved from Boston with one of my close high school buddies. And we used to, on Sundays, we used to leave our apartment at the northern tip of Manhattan and come all the way down to the West Village, the neighborhood I live in now. And we were working on a screenplay together that was a terrible knockoff of The Matrix. And we would, after we left, our working session to go back home uptown, I would often say to my friend Ted, "Hey, man, one day, I'm going to live in this neighborhood."
Oh, and here you've done it. That's wonderful. Yeah, that's a great part of New York. I know Manhattan a little bit, and that's such a fun neighborhood. Thanks for telling us about and I love the fact that you still have a place full of books, even though you got rid of 30 bags of books. I'm a reader too, so I can totally appreciate that. In fact, I live with three other readers. We're all big readers. So yeah, the books tend to take over. And so now I'm wondering, you were at a college here in Grand Rapids recently talking with students as well as others. And this show, as much as it's for anybody who's interested in the topic of values, is also really targeting a younger audience, students in college, young people charting their early days of career. And I'm wondering if you have any advice about how to use guiding principles or core values in order to do that successfully.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it relates to an old fable of sorts about God and the elephant. And I'm sure people have thought about this, right, and mentioned this maybe even on the show. But the idea that, you know, you have five different blind people, and one of them's holding the trunk, and one of them's holding the ear, and one of them's holding a tail, and one of them's holding a leg, and one of them's holding the body, and they all have different, you know, definitions of what God is because of what they're holding on to. And I think that if we are going to try to produce great work and produce great artistic work in a society that is more just and more equitable, it is incumbent upon us that we have multiple perspectives and multiple views building that vision, a chorus of voices that are helping create that that more just society. And therefore, I would encourage all of the young people out there who are listening to the show, that their personal truths, that the values that shape who they are, deserve a voice in the choir, to extend the metaphor, and that they should feel empowered to really present those views and get them out there into the social discourse, because we need them. I was speaking at a school in the Bronx yesterday, and I was speaking with some students who often, as I was told by one of the teachers, are told to, you know, be quiet and follow rules. And my hope when I left the room was that some of them felt a little inspired to tell their stories, to talk about what it means for them to make the walk from home to school, and what fears, reside in their hearts, and what hopes reside in their hearts. Because we need their voices out there in the world right now. And likewise, I would say to the young people listening to this show, we need all of your voices. You and I have the benefit of having our positions of power through the show and through the novels that I've written. But young folks whose voices we haven't heard, we desperately need. And so I would encourage them to embrace their values and add them to the chorus.
Well, thank you for that really wonderful, rich thought. I want to end our discussion just asking you if you have a favorite quote or a poem or song, and if you tell us what it is and what it means to you.
Well, I used one of my favorite quotes in All American Boys, and I've found it attributed to Desmond Tutu, but I think there are variations of this by others, but it's, if you are neutral in times of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. And for me, that quote really resonates deeply, because I think that speaks to my principle of not allowing myself to take the easy road of silence when there is injustice, or when it just feels like it'll make my life more comfortable and easy. But instead, that I need to speak up. I need to listen when people are calling out for support and asking for allies. And I need to be there when they ask. And I need to amplify their voice and shout alongside them. And I think that's a really powerful quote. And Desmond Tutu certainly is speaking at a time when the world rallied and did support a situation of deep injustice in South Africa. And just as we were saying earlier, I think our country could do a better job reflecting on the history of injustice in our nation and the perpetuation of injustice in our nation. So let's not be neutral. Let's not choose the side of the oppressor in our neutrality or in our silence. Let's say something. Let's amplify the voices who've been saying it for a long time.
Yeah, it certainly is a time when we need to have fewer bystanders and more people really involved and engaged. And you are one of those people, Brendan Kiley. I'm so grateful to you for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, a New York Times bestselling author and educator. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning into Your True North. Follow us on Facebook at Your True North Podcasts. Our producer is Sean O'Melia, and our editing and studio coordinator is Lauren Yentz. I'm your host, Cindy Camp. Tune in again for another discussion about values as a compass for life's journey.